what you believe happened.
Yes, we have called for it. This young man was found almost exact date. Emmett Till was killed. He was found hanging, had the wrong shoes. Our own independent pathologist said there was no way he could have done this to himself. We've called for an independent investigation. And nationally, the NAACP has also said the federal government ought to step in around the case of these three young Muslim students that were killed. These hate crimes are serious, and we need to make sure that they are investigated and that justice occurs, and that we say that this kind of hate and violence has no place in our American
society. Reverend Dr. William Barber, we thank you for being with us, president of North Carolina NAACP, author of the book Forward Together, A Moral Message for the Nation. And that does it for our broadcast. If you'd like a copy, go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feld, Sarah Mate, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkaff, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
Frankie and Johnny were sweethearts. At least that's the way the story goes.
Tune in to KABU Monday, February 16th at 7 p.m. for another broadcast from the Steam Radio Syndicate, performing live from a tugboat in the Willamette River. Their focus this time is the Ballad of Frankie and Johnny.
He was her man, but he done her wrong.
Again, that's the Steam Radio Syndicate, Monday, February 16th at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This story has no morrow. This story has no end. This story...
The 17th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national town hall discussion on poverty and homelessness in America.
Homeless people deserve housing, not shelters.
I wish... they would do something about getting people off the streets.
I'm not giving up, and I don't want nobody to feel sorry for me.
That's the Homelessness Marathon broadcast, coming to you soon and heard right here on this radio station.
Hear the Homeless Marathon here on KABU, beginning at 5 p.m. on Tuesday, February 17th, and continuing until 6 a.m. Wednesday morning.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on KABU, it's the evening news.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, a new report shows the impact of climate change will soon reach a point of no return.
A federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit against oil and gas companies, saying they bear no responsibility for wetland erosion on the Gulf Coast.
Oregon death penalty opponents call on the governor to commute the sentences of Oregon's 35 death row inmates before he leaves office on Wednesday.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, February 16, 2015. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Several hearings took place today in the Oregon State Legislature to push forward a bill that would require paid sick leave across the state. Currently in the state of Oregon, 47% of private sector workers and 71% of low-wage workers don't earn paid sick time while they work. Representative Jessica Vega Peterson is one of those who introduced the bill.
So what we're doing in House Bill 2005 is really creating a floor-level standard for a paid sick time policy. So all employers, regardless of their size, are required to provide employees up to 56 hours of paid sick time each year. That's what you find in the bill before you. The reasons that sick time can be taken can be used for the care of themselves or a family member for both mental and physical illness. It also is for the purpose of domestic violence leave is covered in the bill as well. And of course, if there are any closures of school or a place of employment due to a public health emergency or a contagious disease, that's also covered in there. So this is something that you'll find as you walk through that language of the bill.
Representative Widener.
I could. Can you kind of hit on it, Representative Vega Peterson? I'm just kind of curious why we went with 30 hours rather than 40 hours for calculating the time off, because, I mean, we calculate as full-time, usually a 40-hour work week. Why did we go to 30 and not 40, just to make it simple, the way businesses work with their books, to keep the accounting easy for them as well?
Yeah, thank you. Chair Holby and Representative Widener. So thanks for the question. So this paid sick time policy applies to all employees, whether they're full-time or part-time. The one hour of accrual for 30 hours work, we want to make sure that even employees who are working at a part-time rate still have the ability to accrue enough hours of paid sick time that they may need to take care of themselves and their family. This is one of the things that we're having discussions about, and we've received feedback on from different stakeholders. But we decided to go with something that we would have a strong paid sick time available for even part-time workers.
So.
Portland City Commissioner Amanda Fritz testified at this morning's hearing about Portland's policy requiring paid sick leave, which went into effect last January.
We heard so many stories of people who had been disciplined for taking even an hour off work because of a migraine, who lost their jobs because they or their child was sick. We heard from construction trade women who had to go back to work the same week as having a child, because otherwise they lose their seniority. They certainly have the paid bank, but if you don't cover, if you lose your seniority and lose your opportunity to be first at the hiring hall, then that's a problem. So that was why in Portland we did not exempt the construction unions. They're certainly exempted from having to track and provide the payment, but they are covered by the protections against retaliation, and I think that's really important. So I encourage you to keep it simple. Keep everybody in. In our law, if you have a business with five or fewer employees, it's unpaid sick time. If it's six or more, it's paid. That just adds to the difficulty of tracking, or adds to the complexity of tracking. The calculations of when are you five, when are you six, if you fluctuate between the two of those, what happens? It just is not worth the hassle. In fact, we heard from many businesses that it's really they want to keep the administration as simple as possible. And if you think of it like Social Security taxes or other accruals that are tracked regularly by businesses, I think of paid sick time as like minimum wage. It's a standard for which Oregon should have for everybody.
That was Portland City Commissioner Amanda Fritz speaking at a hearing in Salem today. KBOO also spoke with Kim Eggleston, a single mom who works in the food service industry and does not have paid sick leave.
I'm in food service. Worst place to be if you're sick. Honestly, I think food service is one of the last places to give paid sick leave. You know, when I get sick, if I don't go to work, there goes $75 for that day, and I can't get that back. You know, I don't get paid sick time. I don't get paid vacation time. If my son is sick and I have to leave, you know, I can't pay my bills at the end of the month if I don't get it. And I think a lot of people are in that situation. So that is my interest in the subject. I'm hoping that they pass really any bill that requires at least a bare minimum of paid sick leave, especially for families. If you have children, you know, the bill right now is for 56 hours in a year. And if you think about one child, if he gets sick 4 days and I get sick three, we've used it up, and that's really not a lot. So some families are even worse than that. So the hope is that the people that really shouldn't be going to work and that really should be staying home and taking care of their family will be able to without fear of losing their job and going in anyway, bringing that sickness to everyone they work with and everyone they serve.
The Oregon legislature is considering a bill that would require all businesses, no matter what size, to give employees up to 7 days of paid sick leave each year. If they manage to pass the bill, workers would get 1 hour of sick time for every 30 hours of work.
The mayor of West Linn abruptly resigned last week in the middle of his term. This announcement came within days after the announcement that the Lake Oswego Tigard Water Partnership project in West Linn is behind schedule by almost a year. While there's no reason given for Mayor John Kovish's quick departure, some local residents believe there's a connection to the water project, which Kovish supported. The Lake Oswego Tigard Water Partnership was originally designed to provide an increased water supply to both cities, plus an excess amount of water to sell to neighboring municipalities. The project includes an expansion of the existing pump station in Gladstone and the water treatment plant in West Linn, newly built reservoirs, and pipelines under the Willamette through West Linn and Lake Oswego, eventually connecting to Tigard. While Lake Oswego has been using the Clackamas River water for some time, Tigard has no independent water source of its own and has been buying their water from Portland. The group Water Watch filed a lawsuit, which they won on appeal, challenging the massive drawdown of the Clackamas River. Because of that lawsuit, the Lake Oswego Tigard Water Partnership will be extremely limited in the water it can draw from the Clackamas. For more information, KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with Karen Crichton of Tigard First.
This is a $250 million project, this water infrastructure. Pipelines are scheduled to be built under a state park, is that correct?
That's one of the stretches of the pipeline. They've already driven a pipeline underneath the Willamette River. It has to connect from the Clackamas River over in Gladstone, running underneath the Willamette River, underneath Mary Young State Park in West Linn. It will go down highway underneath Highway 43. Highway 43 has been a mess for quite some time now because of this project. Then it'll connect into Lake Oswego from there. And they still are planning to go forward with, they're doing the work to build the pipeline over to Tigard, into Tigard, and to the Tigard pump station, even though the Water Watch lawsuit now says that Tigard doesn't get to use most of their share of the water. And that's a lot of our frustration right now is the utter lack of transparency from either of these cities. We've known about this lawsuit that Water Watch had prevailed in appeals court. We learned about that right at the beginning of the year. And we still have yet to really find anything out from either of our cities. The people in both of these cities, Ello and Tigard, of course, are on the hook financially and otherwise for this massive project. But West Linn has been completely invaded by this thing. Gladstone has suffered a lot with it. And now we find out that Water Watch did prevail in their lawsuit, and we're just not getting any answers to that. That's a lot of the reason why we went out to the media, hoping that people from the media would be able to get answers from the cities about what happens now with this half-built infrastructure and a drastically different water permit than they thought they were going to have.
And in West Linn, the people have been really impacted by this construction of the water infrastructure. Where did John Kovash stand on it? You said he was supportive of the project?
Yes, he seemed to want it. That's a long and sorry tale. It was an incredibly divisive issue at the time for the people in West Linn. I think I can say with confidence the huge majority of the people and the businesses, even the West Linn Chamber of Commerce, didn't want this thing because they knew it would be so disruptive and so invasive. I sat next to a woman from West Linn who lives across the street from the water treatment plant construction project. And she actually has had to live for quite some time now with so much noise and vibration that things actually vibrate off of her counters in her house. And there's people there that have serious concerns about their homes. It's stressful, the noise and the trucks and the rest of the disruption are stressful, but they're worried about what this is. A massive industrial project in the middle of a lovely, peaceful, bucolic residential area. There, the mayor definitely was being held responsible, I would say, by most of the people and the businesses in Westland. That's why there's no question for a lot of people that this is why the reason we feel like the reason why his announcement for his retirement came when it did. It was just a few days after the announcement that the work on the water treatment plant, the portion of the project that's in West Lynn, that is almost a year behind schedule.
Well, again, I've been speaking with Karen Crichton. She is with Tigard First, their website, tigardfirst.org. We've been talking about the resignation of West Lynn Mayor John Kovach and the potential connections to the Lake Oswego Tigard Water Partnership that is now close to a year behind schedule to pipe in water from the Clackamas River all the way across West Lynn to Lake Oswego and to Tigard. Again, this is Jinka Soderberg reporting for KBOO News.
Great. Thanks so much, Jinka.
All right.
Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber will have his last day in office this Wednesday after resigning his post on Friday following accusations of conflicts of interest regarding his fiancée's business contracts. Death penalty opponents have called on Kitzhaber to take the step of commuting the death sentences of Oregon's 35 inmates on death row before he leaves office on Wednesday. Kitzhaber imposed a moratorium on executions during his term in office, but that moratorium will expire 20 days after he leaves office. For more, KBOO spoke with Ron Steiner with Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.
What we're interested for him to do while he's still in office would be to commute the sentences of those on death row. Commutation does not mean that those people are let out of prison or it's just that they will not be subject to a death penalty, which doesn't change a whole lot because we're not executing anybody right now anyhow, under the moratorium or otherwise.
But if the moratorium were to be lifted upon Kitzhaber's leaving office, would executions then resume?
The process would begin again. How soon they would resume, I'm not sure. There are a few people that are relatively close, in Oregon terms, relatively close could mean a couple of years. But if he leaves office without doing anything in terms of commutation, then we would beseech the new governor, Kate Brown, to declare her own moratorium that would stop executions as well. I can't speak for her, and I certainly don't know for sure what she would do, but we would ask her to do that, just like we're asking the current governor to commute to Roe.
In the Oregonian newspaper or online version, they put together a poll of people who want the governor to commute the sentences of the people who are on death row in Oregon. And it's 73% are in favor of Governor Kitzhaber commuting those death sentences before he leaves office. Do you think that's reflective of public opinion in the state of Oregon on the issue of the death penalty?
I think it is to a great degree. That poll was created, I guess, because somebody at the Oregonian wrote a major article that it was possible that the governor does commute death row sentences. So they asked the poll whether folks were in favor of that idea or against that idea, and vast majority of those people responding said that they were in favor of that, that he should do that. Whether it's reflective of the entire state, I don't know for sure about that. It's certainly been a movement toward fewer death sentences and fewer executions across the country, as well as Oregon. So I think it's a combination of the fact that public opinion in Oregon is changing in that direction, plus the fact that those of us who are active in this movement were paying attention to those things and responded in like manner.
And why are you yourself opposed to the death penalty?
Well, there's a whole litany of reasons why I oppose the death penalty. The original one that got me to start thinking about it and learning about the death penalty was when I heard Sister Helen Prejean say some things that indicated that it was not administered fairly, that it was very, very much biased against the poor and people of color. And less than 2% of the people who are convicted of murder get a death penalty, and they're all poor. And a disproportionate percentage of them are people of color. And then I just learned about a whole lot of other things. And today, the message that's resonating with a lot of people, even conservatives, is that we're wasting an awful lot of money on maintaining a death penalty because it's so expensive to do. And while we have underfunding for law enforcement, for addiction programs, rehabilitation programs for addicted, for early childhood education, for intervention into abusive households for the mentally ill, we could be using that money for programs that really do deter crime, and the death penalty does not.
Again, Ron Steiner with Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. The group is calling on Governor Kitzhaber to commute the sentences of the 35 people who remain on Oregon's death row before he leaves office this Wednesday. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Meanwhile in Pennsylvania, Governor Tom Wolf has placed a moratorium on that state's death penalty. Wolf said the moratorium will remain in effect until he has reviewed an upcoming report by a state task force established 3 years ago to review Pennsylvania's death penalty policy. Governor Wolf said his moratorium is based on the fact that the death penalty is a flawed system that's been proven to be an endless cycle of court proceedings, as well as ineffective, unjust, and expensive. But he made clear that it is in no way an expression of sympathy for the guilty on death row. Wolf's action Friday has the most immediate effect on Terrence Williams, a convicted killer who was scheduled to die March 4th. There are 186 people currently on death row in the state, according to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, trailing only California, Florida, Texas, and Alabama.
On Tuesday, Kansas Governor Sam Brownback reinstated a policy that allows discrimination against the LGBT community. 7 years ago, former Governor Kathleen Sebelius had brought state anti-discrimination policies in line with 31 other states. Brownback defended his actions, saying that Sebelius should have taken the measure to a vote through the legislature rather than issue an executive order. Brownback also offered no explanation why this was of immediate importance. He was just narrowly reelected to his second term as governor in November. During his first term and in his reelection campaign, Brownback promised that by cutting taxes, specifically income taxes, growth would happen as a result. However, after the tax cuts, the state of Kansas has had to drastically cut back on education and Medicare by around 30%. The promised growth is non-existent. In fact, it has slowed significantly and is lagging behind 37 other states, including Missouri.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast at 5:45 for an in-depth report by KBOO's Paul Rowland on last week's shooting of an unarmed Latino man in Pasco, Washington. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6, and at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny and warm with a high of 63 and a 0% chance of rain. Today in history, on February 16th, 2005, 10 years ago today, the Kyoto Accord came into effect. The Kyoto Accord aimed to curb the air pollution blamed for climate change. 141 countries signed the accord, pledging to cut greenhouse gas emissions 5.2% by 2012. The U.S., the world's top polluter, has still, 10 years later, not signed the Kyoto Accord. The quote of the day is from scientist James Hansen, who said, "I've been described as the grandfather of climate change. In fact, I'm just a grandfather, and I do not want my grandchildren to say that Grandpa understood what was happening, but didn't make it clear."
It's 5:24. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Shouldn't America have at least one major party that is not beholden to the corporate elite? Well, look here. Just such a party has popped up, raring to roar into the 2016 presidential race. Called the KB Party, it has the funding and political punch to bypass the establishment's control of the election system. But don't rush to sign up. KB stands for Koch Brothers. Yes, Charlie and David, the multi-billionaire right-wing industrial barons who already own several Congress critters, governors, think tanks, AstroTurf campaign machines, front groups, etc., now have their very own private political party. And it's not beholden to the corporate elite, since it is the elite. The Koch boys have rallied roughly 300 like-minded opponents of democracy to their brotherhood of plutocrats, intent on purchasing a president and Congress that will impose their vision of corporate rule over America. At a secretive retreat in January for KB party funders, the 300 barons ponied up $900 million for their campaign. That's nearly $200 million more than the combined expenditures of the Republican and Democratic parties in last year's elections. And it's way more than either of those parties will have for 2016. This means that, in our nation of 350 million people, a cabal of only 300 of the wealthiest will have the wherewithal to narrow the choice of candidates presented to the rest of us, restrict the range of policy ideas that are proposed to voters, imbue the overall campaign with a negative tone, and, most important, shape the governing agenda of those who get elected. This is Jim Hightower saying, the Supreme Court's disastrous Citizens United edict created this mess. To help ban the corporate cash that's clogging our elections and killing our people's democratic rights, go to democracyisforpeople.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture last week approved the first GMO apple for human consumption. The apple, designed by the Okanagan Specialty Fruit Company, has been genetically engineered to not brown after being sliced. It's the first GMO crop in the U.S. to receive approval of a genetic modification that is strictly for a cosmetic condition. The Department of Agriculture, known as the USDA, conducted an environmental assessment before approving the GMO apple, showing the modification would have no negative effect. The vast majority of over 73,000 comments submitted by the public were in opposition to the GMO apple. Critics argue the USDA environmental assessment had multiple problems, including that it failed to take into account the potential negative impacts to U.S. apple sales on the global market. The genetic modification, known as RNA silencing, turns off certain genes in this case, the gene that browns the fruit after it has been cut into slices. The gene affected is an integral part of the apple tree's natural defense system against pests, causing an increase in the amount of pesticides that must be applied to the apple tree and growing fruit. The United States Apple Association is opposed to the newly approved GMO apple. The apple will not have to be labeled as a GMO apple, but organic apples can still be guaranteed to be GMO-free.
A number of U.S. federal laws allow for what is called suspicionless spying on Americans. These laws enable the federal government to read our emails under certain circumstances without a warrant. For more information, KBOO's Ken Jones spoke with Margot Schlanger, professor of law at the University of Michigan and head of the Civil Rights Litigation Clearinghouse.
What is suspicionless spying?
There's two different ways that the U.S. intelligence community can do surveillance of people's communications. They can do it based on suspicion of those people, and then they can also do it based on a much broader kind of collection approach without any suspicion at all.
And currently, what's the extent of this suspicionless spying?
Well, we don't know exactly. What we know is that it's very, very large.
You've written that so far as U.S. surveillance law is concerned, the NSA can, if it chooses, collect nearly everything, including our domestic phone calls and emails. How do they justify this legally?
The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act regulates when the NSA can collect communications if they're targeting particular people, but it does not much regulate what they can collect if they're collecting a huge bulk of communications or if they're collecting based on the subject matter rather than on the person. And so in either case, the NSA can collect that stuff. But I should be clear, one clarification. They can't do it all the time. There are very technical rules about when they can and can't do that, but they can do it a lot of the time.
So even though they're not targeting, say, me in particular, they could read my emails based on just certain words that show up in the emails, or?
Yeah, so suppose they wanted to find people talking about, I don't know, biological warfare. They could filter the emails as long as they do it in a particular technical way and as long as they're using certain technologies to do that, they can filter your emails on the basis of the subject. That's right.
In your writings, you've mentioned several federal laws that authorize this suspicionless spying. There's the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, the Patriot Act. You mentioned one that's even a little more obscure, the Executive Order 12333. How do they relate to each other? And what's the extent of the spying that they authorize?
So FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, doesn't regulate this kind of spying. That's exactly the point. It excludes this kind of spying from its regulation. That's true as well of the Patriot Act. So the only constraint that exists on this kind of what's called untargeted bulk surveillance that's done abroad is under Executive Order 12333. That's an executive order that has governed the collection and use of intelligence information ever since.
What protections do U.S. citizens have to prevent this type of widespread surveillance?
Well, I mean, they have the protection that they can't be targeted, and that is really important. In other words, nobody can say, I'm interested in Margot Schlanger and go and do this with willy-nilly. It's got to be based on a subject, and it's got to be a subject that is reasonably likely to give rise to foreign intelligence. And then there are a set of rules that govern how the information can be used and analyzed once it's collected. All of that stuff is in internal government procedures that are adopted by the Attorney General, signed off on by the Attorney General under that Executive Order 12333. So it's not that there are no protections, it's just that it's a lot fewer than maybe people think.
Are there currently any strong efforts in the federal government by legislators, for example, to reform these surveillance laws?
Well, not this aspect, no. No, this has really been below the radar, I think. There's been a lot of discussion about the FISA surveillance, the surveillance that is targeted by who the government is interested in. And there's been a lot of talk about reforming that, and that may well happen. But there has not been much talk about reforming this.
Yeah, and in fact, I've heard talk about reforming the Patriot Act, but not this Executive Order 12333.
That's right.
I found this interesting. You served as Officer for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties at the Department of Homeland Security a few years ago, 2010, 2011. What was your role and what power did you have to protect civil liberties?
Yeah, so my role was to be an internal office that would try to make sure that the Department of Homeland Security did not unfairly or illegally do any harm to the civil rights and civil liberties that people came in contact with. So I did complaints investigations, I did policy advice, and I did meetings with civil rights and civil liberties groups around the country to get their views and keep them informed.
What can citizens do to protect their email, their phone calls, their texts, and other communications from this surveillance?
Well, I should say that if the phone messages and the email stay entirely domestic, then the NSA's authority is much less robust. The thing is that emails, you can't really control where your emails go. You know, you control who you send it to, but you don't control what path it takes to get there. And so if the email goes outside the borders of the country, then it's open to the NSA to do this kind of bulk surveillance. And really, there isn't very much that U.S. citizens can do about that. That's the way the rules work currently. The thing that people can do if they object to that is they can, you know, try to advocate for changes in the rules.
We've been talking with Margot Schlanger, professor of law at the University of Michigan and head of the Civil Rights Litigation Clearinghouse, about suspicionless spying in the U.S. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
Tens of thousands of Greeks rallied in support of the new Syriza government ahead of Monday's economic summit between Greece and the European Union. Greek solidarity and anti-austerity rallies were also held in dozens of cities throughout the European Union, from Finland to Britain and throughout Western Europe. Negotiations were held today, but promptly fell apart, with each side proclaiming that the other side refused to negotiate in good faith. Leading German officials demanded that no more funds be released to Greece and that the new finance minister be fired and replaced. German officials also stated that Greece could be forced to leave the Eurozone if the new Greek government doesn't continue with the austerity terms of the previous bailout. Greece stated there's no turning back against the austerity measures that has bailed out the rich on the backs of the poor and has already moved to end many of the austerity measures imposed on the nation by the previous bailout accord. Greece announced it canceled the planned sale of multiple utilities that were in the beginning stages of being sold off to international corporations. The new Greek government has also announced plans to raise the minimum wage and pensions to previous levels. A European Central Bank spokesman stated that further funds would not be approved to Greece if the new government does not approve continuing austerity measures. As both sides dug in, the talks fell apart, leaving the Greek government about 2 weeks of funding before it would either need a new round of funding or would default on its international loans. The Greek finance minister reiterated that austerity programs would not be continued, as they have led to a worsening economic situation. The new Greek government has argued that the austerity policies are designed to impoverish the vast majority of Greek citizens. The Greek government has also argued that the vast majority of bailout funds go directly to German banks, and less than 10% of bailout actually goes to Greece. The European Union meets on Wednesday to discuss and coordinate further talks with the Greek government.
A recent study from top universities in the United States, Sweden, Denmark, and Canada has found that human-induced climate change has surpassed four of the nine indicators of irreversible catastrophic changes. The study was published in the journal Science. The researchers who carried out the study said there is an urgent need for a new paradigm that integrates the continued development of human societies in the maintenance of the Earth system in a resilient and accommodating state. One of the study's authors noted that, for the first time in human history, we need to relate to the risk of destabilizing the entire Earth system. The report is based on the idea of nine boundaries that originated in 2009. Each phase stands for boundaries within which humanity can live sustainably and what that would entail. The nine planetary boundaries are climate change, a change in biosphere integrity due to biodiversity loss and species extinction, stratospheric ozone depletion, ocean acidification, large-scale changes to phosphorus and nitrogen cycles, land system changes like deforestation, freshwater use, atmospheric aerosol loading, that is, microscopic particles in the atmosphere that affect climate and living organisms, and the introduction of synthetic elements like radioactive materials, nanomaterials, and microplastics. Each of these boundaries is marked by an irreversible change to our environment. Once the boundaries are reached, the scientists argue a point of no return is likely and no amount of mitigation will be able to reverse the impacts of human-induced environmental impacts that have already taken place. At that point, they say, these planetary tipping points could abruptly and irreversibly change living conditions on Earth. The study pointed out that the human-induced changes have taken place almost entirely in the last 100 years. The prior 12,000 years were incredibly stable.
A federal judge has ruled that 97 multinational oil and gas firms are not financially responsible for the erosion of Louisiana's wetlands. This decision was made even after the energy corporations admitted to being responsible for 36% of the 1,900 square miles that had been lost since the 1930s. On Friday, a U.S. District Court judge dismissed a lawsuit filed in 2013 by Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East against oil and gas companies for their role in the damage to Louisiana's wetlands. For more information, KBOO's Joanna Peterson spoke with Stephen Estopinal, who is the president of Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East.
First of all, can you give me some background on the case?
The Southeast Flood Protection Authority entered into a suit against nearly 100 oil companies, alleging that their oil and gas operations in coastal Louisiana damaged the wetlands and increased the storm surge threat against the flood protection system that we are responsible for maintaining.
What kinds of things are the oil and gas firms saying in their defense?
Their main thrust is that the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority does not have standing to sue them.
Yeah, that's my next question. So these firms have been quoted as calling you a rogue agency. What does this mean? What's that all about?
Well, I think it means they disagree with us entering into a suit against them.
Can you give me some background about the agency? What is its role and why was it created?
Well, the Flood Authority was created after the destruction wrought by Katrina, when many of the people in Southeast Louisiana felt that the levee boards that were in place at that time did not do as good a job as they should have of monitoring the flood protection, and they wanted to make sure that when the Corps of Engineers rebuilt the flood protection, that they had somebody that was qualified to evaluate the job that was done and also qualified to continue with developing the means to ensure the maintenance and the continuation of the flood protection that they were provided.
When did your agency realize that the oil and gas firms were creating a major problem in the wetlands, and, you know, when did you start to take action?
There was a series of events. I think the thing that really brought it to a head was the tropical storm Isaac, when it so unexpectedly caused such high surges well inland from the city of New Orleans. So I believe that's probably when the members of the authority began to realize that something else is happening that increased the storm threat.
I've been speaking with Stephen Estopinal, who is the president of the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East. We've been talking about a case in which almost 100 multinational energy corporations were found to be not financially liable for the erosion in Louisiana's wetlands. For KBOO News, I'm Joanna Peterson.
Since 2010, the cost of solar and wind energy have been dropping to a rate competitive with fossil fuel generation. Despite the falling prices of oil, hydro, biomass, geothermal, and wind power are now competitive with or cheaper than coal, oil, and gas-fired power stations, according to the International Renewable Energy Agency, also known as IRENA. The cost of wind power is decreasing also, but not as rapidly as that of the solar power. The IRENA study says that costs are falling, for the equipment and the technologies themselves are continuing to become more efficient. This has led to the continual and rapid decline in the cost of renewable energy. For example, in 2014, the cost of a solar module was 75% lower than at the end of 2009, not factoring in a savings for the reduced pollution. The majority of growth in renewable power is in India, China, and Indonesia. For the over 1 billion people with no access to electricity, the renewables make the most sense, being less expensive and less polluting. The rate of deployment is still not keeping up with the desire for worldwide power.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zur, Ken Jones, Rosalind Scott, and Joanna Peterson. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elective representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number, at least until Wednesday, is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, on the eve of a series of rallies and marches in Oregon against the fast-tracking of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, Joe Uris leads a discussion of how TPP will affect our jobs, wages, food safety, and access to clean air and water. At 9, on Alternative Radio, professor and author Michael Eric Dyson speaks on Malcolm X and the politics of race. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11